You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Welcome, everyone, to Trek FM's local watering hole, where friends from the network and people just drop by. We talk all things geeky, and I am beyond excited this week because we are going to talk about something that I have loved since I was probably like 6 years old, and it's so much fun to be able to do this kind of thing on the show. And we are going to talk about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the movie that came out in 2006. But this is a story that I think we all kind of have a really long history with. And before we kind of get into everything, I want to introduce who's going to be talking about this with me tonight. And first and foremost, I'm really excited to have Maureen Moser with us, who is, as everybody knows, if you don't know on the network, Darren does our show, Earl Grey. And his wife is with us tonight to talk about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. How are you doing tonight, Maureen?
I'm doing wonderful. Really excited.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad you could be here. I know that you are a big fan of C.S. Lewis, so I'm excited.
Very much so.
Yeah, to have another Lewis fan here. And back with us, so excited when she's here. Andy, how's it going?
It's good.
Awesome. Well, for you guys, you ladies, because there's only one guy on this show, and it's me. So, for you ladies, what is your history with Narnia as a series? Is it something that you grew up with, that you liked as a kid? Andy, what was kind of your first experience with Narnia, and has it been something that you've read for a long time, or did you just get into it?
I honestly don't remember a time when I hadn't read the Chronicles of Narnia. I feel like I must have like read it at age 3 or something. I'm pretty sure it was one of the first books I ever read. Because trying to think back on the first time I read it, I can't. It's just that ingrained with my childhood, to be honest. And I've reread it probably at least 20 to 30 times, the whole series. So it's just one of those that I go back to all the time and have a really fond spot in my heart for. And one of the books that was kind of my gateway into epic fantasy nerddom. Yeah. It started with Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings and all these kinds of like epic fantasy, and I think it's one reason why I still am such a sucker for a big doorstopper book about magical places that are far away. So I owe a lot of my love of all things fantasy to Chronicles of Narnia.
Mm. What about you, Maureen?
Well, when I was a little girl and had first learned how to read by myself, I didn't like to read. And so among the efforts my parents went to help me to like reading, my dad bought the Chronicles of Narnia when I was in the second grade and read them to me at night. And that's sold me on books and on reading. I didn't know that stories get, you know, because all the little stories you'd read in those boring literature books they'd have at school were just, they were boring. But Narnia wasn't boring, and it just kind of swept me up, and I fell in love with Aslan, and I've reread them multiple times since then. And I think my favorite out of the seven was The Horse and His Boy, just for the sheer adventure of it, but I've loved each of them in their turn, some more than others. And it was sweet because I love Narnia so much. My husband Darren actually proposed to me using the DVD box set of this movie that we're going to be talking about. They had they had the bookends in there with Tumnus and Lucy.
Yes, I have those.
Yeah, well, that little Mr. Tumnus lamppost, he had unwrapped the whole box, put the ring on the lamppost, rewrapped it. I couldn't even tell that the shrink wrap had been tampered with, so I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. But it was his Christmas present to me, and so by my parents' Christmas tree, yeah, he had me open it up and he had to goad me into opening because I'm like, well, we're not going to watch it right now. And he's like, just open the box. And there was the ring inside there with the lamppost. So both childhood and adult memories associated with Narnia.
That is awesome. That's a great story. I have that same box set too because it came with the bookends, and they're very much promoed in my living room because they're such beautiful works. I really, you know, for me, I'm a little bit like you. I grew up and I didn't really like to read fiction as a kid. I liked reading nonfiction, and my friends had read this and they were like, you should read this. This is really good. And I was like, oh, okay. And a whole new world was opened up just as Narnia is to the kids in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And, you know, back then, we didn't go in chronological order. The books were numbered in the rankings as Lewis had written them. So my first book to read was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I completely was head over heels with it. And like you, Andy, this was really, I think, the thing that kind of, from that moment on, like I was a geek, you know? And you've got, you know, this and then the Lord of the Rings, and then of course, you know, that led to, you know, me being ready to love Star Wars, and then finding Star Trek, and of course getting into Harry Potter once that finally came out, and like it just led to so many different things. But this was the first love. Like Star Wars is my first like geek love in that sense, but this is the thing that made all of those other loves possible. And so for me, bringing this classic to life was a big deal. And I don't know about you guys, but have either of you seen the animated version that they did like way, way back in the day? Have any of y'all seen that?
No, I haven't seen the animated version. We owned the BBC version, though, all of the BBCs that they did for Narnia.
What about you, Andy? Did you ever see that at all?
No, I haven't actually seen either of those, although I think the Voyage of the Dawn Treader BBC version was on PBS once, and I was like, oh, I know that movie, what that movie is about, but that's about it, because I don't have any memory of either of those.
I'm with you, Maureen, in that I grew up with the animated version and the BBC version. And so I completely remember the bad rubber costumes and the stilted children acting and just the bad production value. But that's all I had, really. So, yeah, I watched those over and over and over again. And my wife and I were actually making fun of the kind of the way the beavers walk the other day as we were watching this movie. We were talking about the BBC versions because that's what she grew up with as well. And so, you know, in light of Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter being massive hits, you know, by 2006, it was pretty inevitable that somebody was going to bring Narnia to life. And those somebodies were Walden Media and Disney, with a little bit of help from Weta Workshop with some of the production props. And so I wanted to talk about a little bit for you guys, the look and the feel just of Narnia itself kind of coming to life on screen. And what did you guys think as you watched the film, you know, and we've all seen it multiple times now, but what were some of your thoughts about the things that you just like love about the film and what they get right about that look of what you think Narnia is going to look like? And what were maybe some of the things you thought, I don't know, I saw it differently. What about you, Maureen?
Well, I loved maybe the first half of the movie more than the second half in terms of looks. I have to admit, it has been a little while since I've watched it because I had really mixed feelings about it. But I loved the scene with Lucy and Tumnus when they first meet because that's a very vivid description in the book. And I felt like they really nailed that in terms of the way it looked, and the CGI was advanced enough so that James McAvoy really looked like he had fawn legs, and I forget, I think he had to like walk a certain way or whatever to kind of help get that the gait down, the goat gait.
Yeah, he would walk on the balls of his feet so that like he would be kind of moving in a way. Yeah, they spent days and days trying to figure out just his walk.
Yeah. But yeah, in terms of like just how you picture that scene going, I think they nailed that scene in particular really, really well.
What about you, Andy?
If we're talking purely production value and the looks and the feel, I would say that they pretty much nailed it. I remember seeing the scene where Lucy first goes into Narnia and she sees the lamppost. I'm like, that's exactly how I always saw it in my mind. And the snow and the just the look of it, it looks like how I always pictured Narnia. I think that most of the flaws in the film come more from story and characterization rather than like the production value, because I think the production value is rather stellar.
Yeah, I think that I would agree with that.
That scene is, I think, probably perfect.
Yeah.
You know, she comes into Narnia, and I think this is something that the director really decided that he wanted in the film. Andrew Adamson, this was his first live-action production. He had directed Shrek, but this is his first live-action movie. And the way that he worked with these kids was, I think, really amazing. Watching behind the scenes, he didn't let Georgie Henley see Narnia until they blindfolded her. They set her where her spot was going to be, where she needed to be. They took the blindfold off and they started rolling the cameras so that the moment that she's seeing Narnia for the first time, we're seeing that on screen. And I think it really works because the performance and the production and everything is perfect so that it feels like this kid has just stumbled into this brand new world. And I think that part is really, really, really cool. And it shows that they put a lot of thought into how do we make this believable? We need children actors that can do this. And how do we make it work where we get the real emotion from them as much as possible? Because they did the same thing with her and Mr. Tumnus. She knew James and they had gotten to know each other, but she had never, ever seen him in costume. She'd never seen the makeup. She'd never seen anything like that. So when she sees him for the first time, her scream and her reaction is real. Like, she was freaked out for a second, and it works perfectly. So those scenes, yeah, and the look of Narnia itself to me is really spectacular. And strangely enough, I you know, they actually filmed in New Zealand, just like Lord of the Rings did. And yet they were able to find landscape that didn't just make you feel like I'm in Middle Earth again.
That's true. I knew they filmed in New Zealand, but I never really felt like we were in Middle Earth. I think maybe partly because it was a lot more colorful than Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Especially once the winter melted.
Yeah. They do a really good job with that, and they blend really well. They went to Eastern Europe to get some of the scenes, like the snow scenes with Mr. Tumnus's house and where that is. So they're able to blend all of that together to make it feel organic. So I really like the way that they bring this movie to life. I think that when it came to kind of, you know, picturing Narnia as a kid, and this was kind of cool. Andrew Adamson said that when he was first thinking about, you know, how he wanted to direct the movie, his idea was, okay, I want to direct what I felt as a child. Like, because we all read and we remember a book a certain way, and that's how he wanted to direct the movie. And I think that may be why we all watched the movie and felt like that part in Narnia itself and everything feels very real. Like, it feels like what we thought it was going to be like, because it was somebody else actually just being like, huh, what did I remember from this story? I want to put that on screen. For you guys, you know, you've read the book. We've all seen books that have been turned into movies. You know, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. And it's it never seems to match up, you know, a lot of the times. And most of the time I feel like, oh, the book is better. How did you guys think of bringing this to life and what you've imagined in the book? Can you guys ever divorce the two? Like, you can say, okay, this is the movie and this is the book. How do you guys approach that? Because we get a lot of that these days with, obviously, like I said, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, all of these books that have gotten turned into movies. How do you guys deal with that?
I always really like movie adaptations because, well, if they're done well, let's make that clear. Yeah. But if they're...
City of Bones, not so much.
Or I was actually thinking about the other series that I loved at around this time was The Dark is Rising. And they turned The Dark is Rising into the most horrifying adaptation where, like, he goes to the mall. And I'm like, what is happening?
Oh,
this is supposed to be in, like, old England. But, okay. But I do like well-done movie adaptations because I think you can bring out new, kind of, like, new ways of looking at things. And if you do it right, it can be, like, a nice companion to a book that you loved. So if I'm trying to decide which I like better, I mean, I don't think you can really top the book. But I think that this is a good adaptation of that book and that there are a handful of scenes and lines and kind of characterization tweaks that they made that I actually really like. One is Edmund, kind of fleshing out why he might be acting like such a brat. You know, what kind of problems he has going on and why he might be resentful of Peter and, like, you know, what would drive him to do such terrible things in the beginning of this book. And I think they do a really good job of that in the movie, whereas in the book, as much as I've always liked Edmund, and I think he's probably my favorite character just because I think he's very interesting in that he is one of the characters that really grows and, like, learns more about himself, because the other three pretty much stay the same. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that Edmund had growing up to do that he needed to do, and we got to see him do that. So I've always found him to be really interesting. But in the book, it's kind of like Edmund is a brat, and now he's doing bratty things. But why is never really fleshed out. It's kind of left underneath the surface, whereas in the movie they kind of bring that to the fore. And I've always really liked that they made the choice to kind of subtly explain why he might be acting out in this way.
I think for me with book adaptations and movies in general, I think I guess it just kind of depends on how passionate I am about the book source. Like, I'm a huge Jane Austen fan, and I've actually really enjoyed several of the major film adaptations that have come out for her books. But I guess the general wisdom holds, though, that the book is pretty much always better than the movie. With Narnia, with Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, I think I got myself so wound up in anticipation for the film that by the time I got to it, to be honest, I wasn't really overwhelmed by it. Looking back, though, as I was thinking about, you know, getting ready for this podcast and everything, I started to wonder, I think I may have been too hard on this one. Definitely not a fan of Caspian or the Dawn Treader adaptations, but I think for Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, in hindsight, I think I need to rewatch it and give it another shot. As far as, like, divorcing the two, I guess I don't have a problem with that because I had already read the book so many times that it was very easy to just be like, okay, here's the book universe, this is the movie universe. Whereas with Harry Potter, I admit I saw the movies before I read the books. And so when I read the books, you know, I'm picturing Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson and all those guys in my head. So that really shaped my view of those books. Whereas with Narnia, I'd already had the image in my head. And I will say, like, as we were talking about, like, the visuals of Narnia, at the very least, that I think they really did nail that. It really did look like it had stepped out of my imagination. Like, especially Lucy and Edmund, the actors they got for those kids, I thought that looks in. Yeah, Skander Keynes really was like Edmund, and Georgie Henley was perfect for Lucy. I think they nailed those casting choices really well. And I think Tilda Swinton, even though her looks-wise. They did some different things with her than what's described in the book, which I'm not sure about. I think just she was really menacing and really scary, and she was a very, very good white witch.
And she doesn't seem human. And that's the most important part.
No, she doesn't.
They don't even change her to look non-human. I mean, they make her a little paler and they give her some really rockin' dreads. But, like, other than that, like, they don't actually change her look very much. All of her inhuman quality is coming from her performance and kind of, well, her face is very strange, which is one of her calling cards as an actress. Is she has this very androgynous, very kind of otherworldly look, which is perfect for this movie. But she also has does a great job of just being so cold, and you can really feel like this is
so cold.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's part of what she had to play, right? Is there's a reason why the witch is, you know, associated with ice castles in winter, because she is deep down, all the way to her core, a frozen, cold person.
Yeah, Elsa, eat your heart out.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Oh,
the original Ice Queen.
I would love to see the White Witch go up against Elsa. I'm picturing that in my head right now.
Oh, that's a battle right there. You know how they have
I'm pretty sure the White Witch
went down to Edmund. Geek battles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, technically, she went down to Aslan.
Yeah,
but
I guess.
Yeah,
but
that's
true.
But
he's still. I don't know. But either way, Tilda Swinton, awesome.
Well, I think Elsa might be too nice. That's the thing. She might be too nice, and the White Witch just isn't going to care.
No, she's not.
I loved her her crown, the icicles like growing out of her head, and then it starts to melt as the spring thaw comes. So like her power is visibly diminishing with it.
I really liked her dresses and kind of the very strangely shaped and kind of just a little bit off dresses, but then the final scene where she puts on her like battle uniform, and she's got like that gold antler crown thing and the really wild makeup, and then apparently when I rewatched it the other day, I was like, I think she's wearing Aslan's mane around her neck.
I never noticed that before. I don't know how,
but that's amazing.
Yeah, those, it's kind of like sadistic and
yeah, she's
twisted.
Like wearing the actual like trophy of her victim into battle. It's awesome. It really, really sells that character and makes us scared for the heroes, because gosh, she just looks so scary. I love it.
And one of the neat things about that character too is that even though she is the stereotypical bad guy in the movie, like, she's the evil queen. Like, there's something about the way that she's played here that it just feels like there's always a lot more going on than just her being the bad person, you know? And I think that's one of the things that Tilda was able to do, is kind of give her that otherworldly quality, as well as imbibe her with something that you weren't just getting, like, she doesn't have a mustache, but you know, the idea of the mustache twirling villain, you know, like there's so much more there. And I think that's really nice when the evil queen doesn't just feel like she's just a bad person, that there's so much more going on here. And part of that is we, you know, from reading the storyline, we know that she has a history here in Narnia. She's been here since the beginning with Aslan, and so they have this history as well, and I think that she's able to kind of bring that in even without them mentioning it really at all in the movie. And I think you can't get much higher of a quality
actor than Tilda Swinton. I mean, she's world class, so, and it's important that they got a really strong actress for that part, because it could have gone really wrong and it could have been really, really bland and one note, but it was not. And I mean, that really anchors the whole movie.
Yeah. I think if I had to point out like any weak links in terms of acting, I have to admit William Moseley and Anna Popplewell as Peter and Susan were not my favorites. I think the younger kids Skander and Georgie were much stronger in their acting than the older two. Maybe that's just me. But
I had more of a problem with Susan's writing than the acting. I didn't like the way they kind of made her, I don't know, almost naggy. I didn't like that she was constantly undermining Peter. And I do understand why they did that, kind of. Like, they were trying to give Peter is deciding to be a hero kind of arc. But it was very unlikable, and I didn't like to see that aspect of her character. But yeah, I did notice when I was rewatching it, I did notice a handful of times where I kind of winced at some of her lines, and I was like, but why? Why would you say that to your brother as he's trying to protect you? Like, why? Why?
Yeah, I don't know if they're trying to set up anything, because, well, I don't know if this is going to be a spoiler if you haven't read
the Chronicles of Narnia. It's, I think...
Yeah. Has that expired?
It's like 100 years ago. We can... Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So she's going to be the backslider eventually for the last battle. And I don't know if maybe they were thinking, if we make all seven of these movies or all seven books, we better kind of start setting her up for that. And I don't know if C.S. Lewis had that in his head when he was writing the books, or if he just wrote them as they came. There's some subtle things, I think, when you look at... Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe and some of the other books where Susan appears that maybe are indicators, perhaps, that she's going to backslide in the last book. But I don't know if maybe for the movie, maybe that's why they had her be a bit more of a nag, because they know, in anticipation possibly, of her doing that in a later movie, if they ever actually make that movie. I don't know.
I think part of the thing with her, too, is that, you know, and it's the... This is why I think both the older children are a little bit off, is because they're also surrogate parents in there, and those people always come off as annoying to those of us who, you know, are maybe the younger. They're supposed to be kind of annoying. Peter is being the father figure to his brothers and sisters because he's been kind of thrust into that role, and Susan is picking up the slack for there being no mother. She's not doing it well, you know, she's not practiced at it. She's not old enough to really be in that role. And I think that for me, I never really judged them too badly, especially Susan, because of the fact that she's in a role that she doesn't fit in. And so if it comes off kind of like, I kind of cringe at it, I think that might be kind of the point. Because I always got that in the book too. Especially the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, not any of the others, with Susan, is that this first book that she is trying to be the adult.
Yeah.
Even more so than Peter. And she's not doing it all that well.
Yeah, I think she's always trying to be the adult. I know in Prince Caspian, they kind of, some of the younger ones snap at her for trying to be the grown up.
Right. Yeah. So I think that they're even playing with that here, and that's probably the reason that they kind of come off like that. For me, the story has always been about Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And she is my favorite literary character. This is my favorite book of all time. And she, for me, had to be... She has to sell it. Like, the other kids revolve around her. And Georgie Henley is everything I ever thought Lucy was.
Yeah, she was.
And she just nails it. Like, she has this effervescence and this beauty and quality in her that is so pure and innocent. And that's exactly who Lucy is. And that's what I love about her, is that, you know, she doesn't have to change. Her character is... virtuous all in of itself from the moment she goes into Narnia, the moment she leaves Narnia. And, you know, she has some moments throughout the series where she'll need some growth, like the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But on a whole, Lucy is the one who always believes and always believes that what is good is going to win. And for me, I love that about her and that purity. It usually doesn't come off well in stories.
No, but that's Lewis's strength, I think, is that it's so hard to write good characters who are to their core good. That's actually why I love Aslan so much, because when you have, you know, bad guys versus good guys, frequently the bad guys are very attractive, if not physically. They're just charismatic, and it just, you know, people, you know, get all excited about these bad guy characters, which is fun, but it's hard to do the same with good characters. And that's what I love about Aslan, is I felt, to me, as a child and even as an adult, it felt like Lewis had really done something unusual and beautiful with Aslan in making him a good character whose team you really wanted to be on just because he was so good. You know, and I think because they had the whole, you know, he's not a tame lion thing. He is dangerous and big. And I guess, you know, the whole talking animal thing was just cool too. You know, who wouldn't want to be friends with a talking yeah. lion? You know, and yeah, but I think it's the same with Lucy. Just her, it is hard to do that with a character, to make them good and make them likable
and at interesting. The same time.
Yes, and interesting. And mm-hmm. Lucy is definitely that.
Yeah, for me, Lucy, her strength is her curiosity and her sense of wonder, which she never loses. And she's just,
yeah.
she does exactly what you should do when you go into a fantastical place, which is she's like, wow, awesome. I'm going to go make some friends. I love that about her, that she meets this fawn in the woods and it doesn't even occur to her to be scared or not want to be this fawn's friend. I love that. This like trusting nature is really amazing to me. And it's contrasted so strongly with Edmund's first trip into Narnia. And that's probably mm-hmm. why Edmund is my favorite, is mostly because of this contrast with Lucy, is just like the way he approaches things so differently, and how, you know, if it always makes me think, what if Lucy had met the White Witch and Edmund had met Mr. Tumnus? Like, how would they have reacted differently? And that has always like spun me a little bit, because it's super yeah. interesting the way that plays out, and how they're both of their first trips to Narnia are just totally different.
Yeah, I think those two are definitely the pillars of this story. I think maybe that's why, like, maybe in the movie and in the book, Susan and Peter just kind of have a bit of a backseat to Edmund and Lucy. You know, because you've got Lucy's kind of her discipleship building up, you know, to trust in Aslan, to you know, be just kind of buy into this wonderful Narnia world. And then you've got Edmund and his journey as the traitor and then being redeemed and all these things. And so it just, I think it maybe overshadows the other two kids a bit, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. You can't make every character the main character, but I think those two just are so good. They just overshadow.
Yeah. I just love things. Edmund's journey and how you can see him.
Yeah.
And there were a handful of moments in the movie that I really liked for Edmund. One of them is when he is actually in the movie, they change it so Mr. Tumnus is in jail. He's not stone. So he mm-hmm. gets to actually see with his own eyes what his actions have done. And you can kind of see that mm-hmm. moment where he's like, what have I done? And then like him slowly making it back to himself. And I love that. And that Tilda Swinton also gets a great line in there, and she was like, do you know why you're here, Mr. Tumnus? It's like, oh, because of justice and I believe in a free Narnia. And she's like, no, it's because he sold you out for sweeties. And just the Ooh. Twist of the knife, because it's so beautifully done. And I mean, it works in the books too, the way Edmund comes to his journey too. But I just really like that moment. Like, he actually gets to see the consequences of his betrayal, and we get to see him see that and see that turn where he decides to become a better person. Love it.
Yeah.
Well, it's really cool. I mean, my three favorite literary female characters are Lucy and Elizabeth Bennet and Jane Eyre. And what I love here in the film is that we have a really strong young female character who is, she's not, you know, damaged or overly complicated or any of those things, but she's a beautifully strong female character. And it's because mm-hmm. of her belief and her, like you were saying, Andy, her curiosity and all of these really amazingly beautiful qualities that, you know, really aren't celebrated as much anymore as they should be. And I think that's one of the things that I love about Lucy is that, you know, she's who, if I have a daughter, well, one, we're naming her Lucy. and two, that's what I want her to be like. You know, that's this character has character and virtue and all the things that I would want my daughter to be. And I think that's really beautiful to have that picture for, you know, young girls. You can be strong and amazing and be all of these things just like Lucy. And that doesn't make you, that's what makes a really strong woman. You know, you don't have to be damaged and all these things to be a strong character in a movie. And I think you are completely right on, Maureen. Lewis had a way of writing these kind of characters that they didn't come off boring. And I think part of that is his genius and his brevity. He's very efficient with his words and how he tells a story. And he only gives you exactly what you need for the story. And I think instead of, you know, writing a huge tome, it's 600 pages for one book, he tells you a very simple story, but you feel like it's fleshed out. And I think it leads to something like this. And let's talk about some of the other things that we have here. We did have Liam Neeson, who plays Aslan, and then James McAvoy playing Mr. Tumnus. These are some really, and then, okay, of course, Ray Winstone and Don French playing the voices of the beavers. These are some of the most memorable creatures in Narnia coming to life. What did you guys think about how they did with their portrayal and the way they portrayed them on screen?
Well, I think this is what made me have mixed feelings about the film, was because I think Aslan is my favorite character from Narnia. I wasn't too over the moon with his portrayal in the movie. I think the CGI was fantastic. They did a great job with that. So in terms of like looking and moving like a lion and all that and looking like he was really there, that was spot on. But and this could be just fangirl nitpicking. But like
that's
I said,
okay.
I do
that here on the show all the time.
Well,
right, Andy?
I got really wound up about this, so maybe it just was inevitable it was going to let me down. I guess I was not. If you're going to make a CGI lion, you can make him as big as you want. And it was just odd to me that he was shorter than the kids. I know a real lion standing on all fours is probably might not be as tall as a human boy. Still scary, but Lewis was always impressed upon the reader the size of Aslan. He's not a normal sized lion. He's huge, and I think that adds to his presence. And the other thing was, as much as I like Liam Neeson, I didn't really care for his voice acting. I felt like he was kind of staid and boring, which really bummed me out, because to me Aslan was not a boring character, and I felt like maybe they should have gotten someone with a more wild sounding voice, not like over dramatic or anything, but just something else, a different quality. I don't know if it's because Aslan's like supposed to be a Christ-like character, and so we just seems like in movies and stuff, you know, Jesus or God always has to have like this really boring voice. I don't know why.
It's so true.
I don't know why that is. So I don't know if that's what this, so they decided to go with Liam Neeson or whatever as, you know, this this really straight arrow.
Well, and he can be so non-boring. Obviously, you know, you've seen him in like Taken or any of those kind of films where he's like really action-y and, you know, like he can really drive into a character. So, yeah, I feel like...
I think if they had let him use like his Irish accent, that actually would have been really cool.
Yeah. An Irish lion. I like
it. Just
and
something
Lewis
in
is
there.
Irish as well. Yeah. He grew up, I mean, he's from Ireland. So
he is.
That would have been really, really cool. Yeah. I like that. I'm with you. I always wondered why Aslan wasn't bigger. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like he should be taller. I'm not like, I mean, I didn't need him to be so much bigger, but I mean, maybe like 20% bigger.
Yeah.
Just so that he's like on the same level as the kids. Like he's their same height.
Yeah.
I always felt like he wasn't big enough for me either. So I'm completely with you. I don't think you're off base there at all.
Okay, good. But the others, like Mr. Tumnus, I thought was fantastic. And the beavers were definitely a step up from the BBC version as much as I liked the BBC. They didn't look like gigantic furry footballs. You know, so I think they definitely improved on a lot of things.
I would never have thought that James McAvoy could play Mr. Tumnus like that. And I like James McAvoy, but I was still like, I was impressed the first time I saw it, and I just get more and more impressed with that. He's so gentle and sweet, and he's perfect for Mr. Tumnus. He really nailed that role.
Yeah.
Oh, this is one of the first times I really saw him in anything.
And me so too. I'd never seen him before.
And I didn't have a lot of other expectations of him as a character or anything, and I think you're right. The way that he plays it really is fantastic, and I love the vulnerability with which he plays the role. If you hear him talk in the extras, he's talking about the ramifications of, you know, he was really getting into this the headspace of what it would like to be like to be Mr. Tumnus, you know, and have this pressure of what the queen is requiring him to do and knowing what it would be like to let Lucy go and what could happen to him and all of that. And so, you know, he really dove into playing that character and all the little nuances he does and the way he walks and everything. I thought it was, you know, that's Tumnus. You know, I think he nails the role. And that's what you want from this book, because I think the characters that you need to work, you need Lucy and Edmund to work, and you need Mr. Tumnus to work, because he's going to be the first character you meet in Narnia.
Yeah.
And so if he doesn't, or the look of him doesn't work, yeah. I really like that. And having Ray Winstone, who played another CGI character in Beowulf, he's Beowulf. And so what you can do with somebody's voice and the character they can play, and here he's playing, you know, Mr. Beaver, is just, I really, really like that. And it was fun to have Dawn French, because she plays the portrait of the fat lady in Harry Potter. That's the
Which,
same actress.
Which incarnation of the fat lady? Because didn't they change actors?
She's in the third
Prisoner
movie
of Azkaban.
Okay.
Yeah, at Prisoner of Azkaban and beyond. So
okay.
Really, really like what they did there. I think it really, really worked to have those two people do those voices. And I'm trying to think. Okay, so let's recast Aslan's voice. I'm thinking, just because he does everything and he could do it so well, I'm thinking Aslan would have been cool if he had been Benedict Cumberbatch.
I don't know.
You don't think he can do? You don't think he can do? Is it? He only have an evil voice. He doesn't have a.
No, I'm just sick of Benedict Cumberbatch. He doesn't need to be okay. in every
yeah.
single thing, guys.
Okay, well, I'm just throwing something out there. You guys, what?
I actually kind of feel the same way. Like, he's cute as Sherlock, but actually, I don't think he's like that fantastic. But I don't know. I remember when they were coming out with the film, I got to go to, my dad took me to this kind of conference thing at Biola University, and they had, it was for film and television and stuff like that, and they had some of the people from the Narnia film there, and they showed the trailer there. I don't know if that's where they premiered it or not, but and I don't know if they had cast Aslan's voice yet, but they mentioned some of the other people they had lined up. And I remember Gerard Butler's name came up That would have been rather interesting, especially with his Scottish brogue.
Mm-hmm. That could have worked, yeah.
So I don't know what he would be like as... Oh, no, we have heard him as a voice actor. He did Stoic.
How to Train Your Dragon.
How to Train Your Dragon. Yeah, okay, yeah, and actually he was really good. So maybe he would have been good as Aslan.
I was thinking Jeremy Irons myself.
Jeremy Irons would have been fantastic.
He voiced another
And he did that really well.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, Jeremy Irons is just one of those people that I think has one of the most epic voices in history. And every time Jeremy Irons is talking, I'm just like, So I would have enjoyed that.
It doesn't help that in The Lion King, you had Jeremy Irons.
And James Earl Jones.
And James Earl Jones. I mean, can you get better deep sounding lion voices? So... I think we're on to something here that, you know, you could just redub those lines with another actor.
I didn't mind Liam Neeson. Maybe. I mean, I thought he was fine. I see why you might not have connected with him, Maureen, because I do think he plays it very calm, which can definitely read as boring. So I definitely see your criticism there, but I didn't actually have a problem with it.
I don't think he was horrible.
It wasn't quite what you wanted, and I can certainly understand that.
I feel like it needed to be kind of like you got this feeling of restrained wildness.
Yes, that's what would have been nice.
There's always this moment where you, like, and you should feel it because that's the point of Aslan, is he's not safe, but he's good. Yeah. So you should always feel like there's a moment this lion could snap and just tear you pieces. But that he's restrained all of that to have the kindness come out.
Which is actually why I was thinking of Jeremy Irons, because he has a great villain voice, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we're talking about, you know, big name actors and stuff. But I don't know, maybe a professional voice actor would have been better.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's, you know, Liam Neeson, you know, was a big name and everything probably helped. You know, kind of sell that a little bit, but yeah, maybe somebody who that is what they do for a living, and that's what they're trained to do, would have been better instead of a big name actor.
Well, and knowing the voice actors that I know from things like Star Wars, The Clone Wars, and things like that, those people are incredible at what they do, and I'm with you. You don't have to have a big name. That's just kind of become the thing in Hollywood to do, is to have a big name voice things. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And
he isn't
terrible. I think that he does play it a little bit too restrained, and it would have been nice to have just a little bit more passion in there, I feel like, sometimes. So I think we've all said, you know, this is a loved story. And it's one of the world's most loved books. And, you know, thinking about it now and being removed from all the pressure of what you wanted it to be, do you feel like this movie does do what Lewis created with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe justice?
Well, like I said, as I was getting ready for the podcast, I was starting to think that maybe I'd been a little too hard on the film when it first came out. I think it comes very close. I think I might have to rewatch it to see if I feel differently now than I did when it first came out. And also having to like divorce myself from the other two, which I really didn't like. But yeah, I think it comes, very, very close for me. I don't know if I would give it a complete A+ though.
Yeah, for me, I would say that it's a good adaptation. It's a very, very solid adaptation. There were a handful of parts of it that got to be a little bit too cliche, epic fantasy for me. But for the most part, I think that these were people that really understood their source material and what was the themes and that they were trying to get across, and they nailed some of the most important elements. So Edmund and Lucy and Mr. Tumnus and the White Witch, I think were all basically exactly right. So yeah, there are a handful of things that I would change, but I would say that this is one of the more solid book adaptations that we get. And it's certainly way better than the ones we get later for this series. I mean, I would never even rewatch Prince Caspian ever.
Mm-mm. So, you know, I really am. I'm with you guys. You know, there's only one thing I think that I would change completely about the movie, and it is if you're going to keep it in, you need to redo it completely, because the river scene is the production value on it, as much as they tried, it's just not good. It doesn't look good. It's not from the book. So,
no.
And I don't mind. I know why they have it in there. It's a movie thing. It just doesn't look good. So it's either you redo it and make it look better, or you just take it out.
This is also when we got some of our most unlikable Susan moments, and also when Peter hesitates. I don't know that I would agree with you that this is one of the... I honestly think they should just take it out. And I understand that from a pacing perspective, they want to have an action beat here, but it's not necessary. It just slows us down from getting to the meat of Narnia, which is the stone table. And it's not good character moments for Susan or Peter. And it's not intense. And you're right, Matthew, that especially compared to the rest of the movie, the production value is not up to par here. I would honestly just take it out. It's not necessary.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking about that scene as well, that if you take out all the effort and the resources you put into that scene and redo Aslan's resurrection scene, which to me was a weak point for the film, because in the book it's so exciting and they have that romp with Aslan, which I was really looking forward to, because you couldn't do that in the BBC version with that giant puppet. Yeah. You know, it wasn't going to move like that. And that was one of my favorite scenes in the book. He comes back and the girls get to romp with a lion, which, again, how awesome would that be? And you know he's not going to kill you. So that, as a kid, was one of my favorite scenes. And the fact that they skipped it in the film and instead spent, like, time on that river scene or whatever else is like, what? Really? So that would probably be one of the things I'd redo.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, Aslan actually, like, throws them in the air. I can see why that would be hard to shoot, but still, like, they could at least try to have that kind of playful scene, because I think it is important that Aslan going into that scene is very depressed and downcast, and then afterwards it's like new hope and... Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
He's triumphant. And
I do agree that they should have had at least something. Maybe not as much as I love it, the fact that he, like, throws them in the air. I think that's great.
That would have been
I can
awesome.
See how that could not work from a movie perspective. Yeah. CGI lion tossing little girls in the air.
That's true.
But yeah, I'm with you. He does. He comes back joyful and triumphant. So, it would be nice if that scene played out just a little bit longer as well. I think last thing kind of want to talk a little bit about was just the music of Narnia and the production value of like what the world looks like with, you know, after seeing Lord of the Rings, that's a very important part. And so how they create the world, the props they use, the fact that so many of the creatures are real, like the minotaurs and a bunch of those fauns, the centaurs, the way they do them on screen. They had people there and in all this armor and everything as much as possible. And I think that really added to the way this feels. It feels, you know, you see a minotaur, you could go up and touch it, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and what did you guys think about the way all that worked?
Well, you mentioned the music. I love the music. There are actually a handful of moments, especially in the beginning and then some of the battle scenes, where the music actually gets me enough that I start to choke up a little. I'm like, yeah, man, yeah. And that's what a good score does. You know, it manipulates your emotions without having to use dialogue or anything. It's using music to set the scene and the tone. And sometimes if you do it well enough, it can cause an emotional reaction all on its own. And I love that about the music. And some of the prop details are really cool. I really liked the witch's wand and the way that they made that, because it looks like a weapon, which is what it is. And I mean, you just how long it is. Like, you could totally just give her, I don't know, some sort of small wand, more like Harry Potter wand. But I thought that this version of, like, this weapon, long staff-like weapon almost, looked really, really cool. And just, like, little things like that. Or, like, the crowns at the end. I thought the crowns were really beautiful. Stuff like that really helps with your world building. And I thought they did a good job. It doesn't make me surprised at all to know that Weta did it, because obviously Weta detail work is their bread and butter, so.
Yeah.
I think visually, like color-wise and the way the costumes looked and everything, it really, it looked like Narnia. And this, most of the scenes, like the places they chose to shoot, I think were really good. I wasn't too big on the big battle scene at the end, just this kind of like big blank field felt a little nondescript to me. They had those rock formations at the end though, so I guess that was kind of cool. But I loved Cara Paravel. I thought that was beautiful. That looked like the way a fairy tale castle should look. And near the end, when they're adults, I actually based the colors for my wedding off of that scene, because I loved the rich, like purples and oranges and reds of that scene. And I think it's pretty, I think they had Georgie Henley's older sister play Lucy, which I thought was super cute. So, I think that's, I will give it that in terms of, like, it really did look the way Narnia should look.
Well, and I love, I really do love, you know, if you're going to bring mythological creatures to life, which we all have pictures in our minds of what fauns look like, either from the drawings by Pauline Barnes from the Narnia books, which fantastic, beautiful, amazing artwork, or, you know, we've, you know, seen them in mythology books or other things. I think they just, Weta was the perfect people to go to do the production design there for those creatures and to make them look real and to really work with that on screen. And then, of course, them doing the armor work like they did on Lord of the Rings and the weapons, that kind of stuff. And then the costumes, you know, the way that everything looks when they're in the 40s.
Yeah,
is really well done. It all feels like all of those characters live in that world. You know, they did a ton of study of what you know, the fabrics were that people would wear then, what they would be wearing. All of that, I think, looked really really good. And even just that 1940s world of London. They figured out, okay, you know, what train station would these kids be at for real if they were going to the country, you know, what the train line would look like. So all those little details add, I think, so much. And then, of course, when you get to Narnia, it really pretty much looks just like my imagination always pictured it looking. And to be able to say that to a book that's my absolute favorite, I can't give it a higher, you know, rating than to say it looked like I thought it was going to look like. And you know, when you watch Harry Potter or even Lord of the Rings, there are certain things in there where you're like, that doesn't look the way I thought it was going to look. But on a whole, there's nothing in this book, this movie, where I'm like, other than Aslan, I just wish he was bigger. Everything looks exactly what I thought it would look like.
I think one of my favorite, like, Narnia insider geek moments were the little details with the professor, with Professor Kirk.
The apple snow box.
Like the little the little silver apple on his desk. And then when you look at the wardrobe, it's carved with scenes from The Magician's Nephew. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. So I loved, like, those little details. I geeked out over. I thought that was really awesome.
Well, I think in the end, to me, watching the behind the scenes, Andrew Adamson loved this material. And in fact, when they were interviewing him, they said the interview really turned around and he said, well, look, I'm just going to be honest with you. I've heard that there's some scripts out there and I pretty much don't want to make those. And they were like, okay, this is the guy. And I think the way that he worked with those kids, the fact that they all come off as kids, so whether they're obnoxious sometimes or bratty or any of those things that we don't kind of like, they come off as real kids. It's fantastic. And I think he just worked tirelessly to make the Narnia that he remembered as a kid. And that's why so many people reacted the way they did to it. And I guess if, as we kind of wrap up, what would you rate this movie, Narnia? Where would you kind of say it ranks for you?
Are we doing this out of five?
We'll do it out of six.
Okay, then I'll give it 5 out of 6. There are a handful of small awesome characterization things that I wasn't super fond of. And, you know, there were a handful of scenes that I wasn't super fond of, like the river scene. So I would definitely not say it was perfect, but it was a very good adaptation, and I quite enjoy this movie.
I think I'd have to say the same. Definitely not spot on, but I think, like I've been saying, like looking retrospect back to it and everything, I think it was a lot better than maybe I first thought it was. So I think I'd give it a 5 out of 6.
I think this movie, yeah, 5 out of 6. And because it's a lot like Mary Poppins, it's practically perfect in every way. You know, it's practically perfect. It's not perfect, but it gets as close as I wanted it to. You know, you can never make the perfect movie for everyone anyway.
That's
and,
true.
And so I love that I can watch this. And as a fan of this book from, you know, the age of 5 or 6, that I like it. That means something, you know. There's a great quote in You've Got Mail where she says that, you know, when you read a book as a child, it becomes part of your identity in a way that no other reading in your whole life does. And so the fact that this is a book that so many people grow up loving and watch this movie and for the most part really like it, I think means a lot. I'm really pleased with what we got. Would you guys like to see somebody? Because we've all said we don't really like the other two films, Prince Caspian and Voyage of the Dawn Treader, that they did. Would you guys like to see somebody kind of remake all of these and really do all 7? And would you like to see them maybe animated, like do a completely animated series? Or what would you guys like to see Narnia done as in the future if somebody decides to do this again?
I mean, I think you could make a really epic 7-movie series out of it. Really, this is just making me wish that somebody made a good Dark is Rising set of movies. Because at least we got Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is the most important one, and we got it mostly right. But, yeah, I mean, you could really do a good job with these movies, I think, and you could really make them very, very good, especially, you know, bringing in some of the other elements, like the Magician's Nephew, I think would really, really be cool if somebody did it right.
Yeah, I think, I would like to see them remade and all 7 made and hopefully done as well as they can be. I have to admit, I was kind of relieved that they didn't keep going with the movies, or at least haven't thus far, because Prince Caspian and Voyage of the Dawn Treader were so disappointing that the later books are actually some of my favorites. Horse and His Boy, Magician's Nephew, Last Battle, those are probably actually some of my favorites. And I was kind of glad they didn't get to them so that they couldn't ruin them for me. I don't know if I'd want to see them animated, though, or live action, because kind of the fun of the live action film is feeling like it's really coming to life, whereas an animated film, I don't know if it would feel like it's so much coming to life. Then again, there are some really good animation studios out there who make really good movies, and some movies that are sometimes better, much better than live action. So I don't know. I think I'd be a little torn on in terms of the medium used.
The only reason I asked is just because at that point you can do whatever you want visually.
This is very true.
And so it's and it will all look good. There is something about having that live action version that really does, yeah, it does make it pop off the page. It brings it to life. It makes it feel real, even though it's not. So I would love to see this redone and by a studio that does really get the storylines, doesn't change them, doesn't make them crazy. That's one of the things that Prince Caspian and the Voyage of the Dawn Treader did, is that they changed up too many of the story plot threads to really make them feel like what we knew the books were. And yeah. It didn't help the storylines. It didn't help the movies either. So, yeah, I think this is definitely a series that hopefully somebody will do, because there's, I'd love to see The Silver Chair done. It's an amazingly kind of creepy story, and the visuals in that would be fantastic. Yeah, there's just some great stories here. Horse and His Boy has some epic visuals. I'm thinking like Lawrence of Arabia style.
Yeah.
Visuals you could get. So this is a series that really is ripe for somebody to do it and to do it right. So hopefully that will happen someday in the future. But
and maybe they would make it into 8 movies, since we seem to be doing that thing where we split the last book, you know.
Not necessary for this one.
I wish they'd stop that.
It's rarely necessary, but they keep doing it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Unless it's for their pocketbooks, I guess.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for talking tonight. It's been amazing getting to talk about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but it is not the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this past week. So here is a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I think it was a very anticlimactic thing for a lot of people, because they were expecting me to do, you know, my rah and ranting thing, but instead I just was like, oh, that's depressing. Okay, bye.
Earl Grey.
They've now shifted into the Biff-controlled 1985.
Who got a hold of the almanac in order to turn yesterday's Enterprise?
The Enterprise C is the DeLorean in this scenario.
The Orb.
I'd like to see the Borg assimilate Ferenginar, and then they would become bankers. You know, I could see...
Oh my gosh,
I could see
bankers.
Drones. Yeah, yeah.
The world's strictest bank ever. Right. I'm sorry, you have not paid your loan. You will be assimilated.
The nanites go into you.
Yes.
To the journey!
I kind of want something with a little bit more teeth. For some reason, like starting a garden just doesn't scream mirror universe to me.
Starting a garden doesn't have teeth.
The Ready Room.
I hate to put it this way, but maybe in some strange, twisted logical sense, if Archer just kind of flew on by and didn't help the colonists, the Enterprise D would have never crash landed on Viridian.
So it's not Troy's fault, it's Captain Archer's fault.
Literary Treks.
This is something that doesn't get done a lot in books, because I don't think the time period's supposed to be that long.
Mm-hmm.
But what did you end up thinking about having a story take place before Where No Man's Gone Before?
Well, I thought personally that it was really cool.
The 602 Club.
My two favorite scenes in the film are Cap saying language and then the rest of what the jokes that go with that, and then Cap moving the hammer just enough, then Thor's face when he can't pick it up is priceless.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows, find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe, and of course beyond, like Narnia. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user and you really love our shows, we'd love for you to help us out in a few ways. You can subscribe to us as well as give us a star rating and review. Both of those things help us rise in the rankings in iTunes and just make it easier for other people who enjoy talking about movies and all sorts of things like we do here on the 602 Club easier. Also, right now, we are trying to get to 50 reviews on iTunes, and we're trying to do that by June 1st. And if that does happen, we're going to look at all those reviews we get in the U.S. store, and we're just going to pick somebody at random, and they will win a superhero Blu-ray of their choice, as well as an Eagle Moss USS Vengeance, which Norm has, which we're really excited to give away. So we'd love to be able to hit that, and you can help us do that. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find the shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from the website, and you can grab the RSS link as well. Another important thing, and the best way that you can really help us out, is to keep all of our shows coming to each week by visiting Patreon. And you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/trekfm and you'll find all the current goals we have, milestone contribution levels. We are a listener-supported network. We just do this on a volunteer basis, so we need your help to keep things going. We appreciate all the support you give us, and we hope that you'll join our team. You can find us again at patreon.com/trekfm. And I wanted to say a special thanks. We got an iTunes review from Admiral Rex. Gave us a fantastic 5-star review. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. And you're in the running, of course, for the contest. Another special thank you to our associate producers, Norman Lau, for his support of the network and the 602 Club. He's on Twitter at Norman Lau. And, of course, a big supporter of the Star Trek Axanar Project can be found on their official Facebook page as well as the Babel Conference. And he's also the host of Warp 5 with Will Wynn. Also like to thank Ken Tripp for his support of the network and being an associate producer here on the 602 Club as well. If you would like to contact us, you can do that at trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail. Just look on the sidebar on the show page. Go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. And of course, our listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference. Have an amazing conversation. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Ladies, thank you so much for joining me here tonight. Now, Maureen, is there anywhere that listeners can you find you online?
Oh, not really, actually. I'm not big on social media.
She's
or anything
mysterious.
Like that. Although I that like Pinterest.
Is okay. Yeah, she likes to be mysterious.
I do love Pinterest, so I guess you could find me on Pinterest, maybe.
Oh, there you go. What is your Pinterest name so people can follow you there?
Oh, okay. I think it's at LadyM1138.
Oh, good, good. And, of course, too, if they'd like to get in touch with you, they can always contact Darren. He's on the Babel Conference on Facebook, or at Dr. Sci-Fi on Twitter, and they can let him know how much they love you.
I hope so. I hope it would be that sort of message.
Andy, of course, let everybody know where they can find you.
Well, I just started DS9, so if you want to first-time track DS9 with me, you can do that on Twitter.
Who's that badass bald captain on your avatar these days?
Yeah, I got a lot of really cool, excited responses to the fact that I'm finally hitting Deep Space Nine. So that's on Twitter, at first-time-track. You can also check out my archive project, which is at firsttimetrack.tumblr.com, and you can also check out my podcast Women at Warp at womenatwarp.com. and I am now looking up Maureen so we can be Pinterest buddies.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Well, you guys can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine exclusively. So as Andy is watching Deep Space Nine now, you can find all of our Deep Space Nine talk there on The Orb here in the network. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And of course, I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for visiting Narnia with us this week. And y'all come back now, you hear?